We're speaking with Professor Michael Nassini of the Anthropology Department at Western Michigan University and Liz Mantek, also with Anthropology, about the ongoing excavation at Fort St. Joseph in Niles. And Professor Nassini, remind us, what is Fort St. Joseph and why is it important?
Yeah, Fort St. Joseph was a settlement established by the French in the late 17th century. It's one of the oldest European settlements in the Western Great Lakes. And it was critical to the French. It was situated along the St. Joseph River. And so it really was a stronghold for the southern part of Lake Michigan. It was actively involved in the fur trade. It was a staging area for some of the French battles with some native groups. It was a place where there were priests who were involved in religious conversion. And it was just critical in a whole string of posts that the French maintained on their western frontier. It was just a very important place for them.
I believe it's sometimes referred to as the Fort of Four Flags.
Yeah, and Niles to this day is called the City of Four Flags. So not only were the French there, but the English took over the site in, 1760, 1761, and they held it briefly. And, of course, it came under American territory later, but not until the Spanish came and took the fort over for a single day.
Okay. Did the fort look like what we're used to seeing forts look like in the movies and TV with the log palisades and all of that?
Yeah, and that's the impression that a lot of people have, right? The log palisades and even the block houses and so on. And early reconstructions, at least on paper, of the fort depicted it that way. We're really challenged to understand exactly what Fort St. Joseph looked like because there are no documents. I can't emphasize that enough. There are no documents. There are no descriptions. There are no drawings. Of course, there are no photographs of Fort St. Joseph. So understanding what it looked like is entirely dependent on the archaeology. So the very brief descriptions we have suggest it did have a palisade. We don't know how large it was. We don't know how many buildings was inside of it. We suspect probably most of the buildings were actually outside of it. It was just a small stronghold. And it's been difficult to identify this ephemeral line of posts. Instead, what we have been identifying is a series of buildings, and I can talk a little bit more about those.
Let's get to that, but how long did the fort exist physically?
Well, it was initially established as a mission in the 1680s, and it was in 1691 that a fort was constructed. And then it was in operation, occupied until 1781. So about 90 years, there were maybe 50, 60 people there, a commandant, soldiers, fur traders, a priest, a blacksmith, an interpreter, native women, French-Canadian women, kids running around. We know this because we have a baptismal record and a marriage record as well. So we know the priest was marrying native women with French men and so on. And so 50, 60 people for almost a century.
And there were buildings either on the inside or the outside of the fort that those where people lived.
Yeah, the types of buildings that we would expect to see, and we've identified some of these archaeologically, of course, are our habitation structures, and that's what we've been working on. There probably was, according to the records, there was a jail that was constructed in the 1750s. There might have been storehouses for some of the trade goods. They didn't have much in the way of domesticated animals, so there probably weren't that many outbuildings, like barns and sheds and that sort of thing. But those are some of the buildings that probably existed at the site, mostly habitation.
Why did the French pick that site, what is now Niles, for their fort?
Well, you know, decisions about settlement location are sort of multifaceted. So there's a number of reasons, at a number of different scales, if you will. So one of the reasons they were on the St. Joseph River was because it was an important thoroughfare. It's a place that LaSalle had explored very early on in French colonial history. The Fort St. Joseph River, specifically at Niles, near South Bend, South Bend, named for the South Bend of the St. Joseph River, is in close proximity to the headwaters of the Kankakee River. And someone might say, well, so what? Well, the Kankakee River leads into the Illinois River, which leads into the Mississippi River. So there's essentially a practically uninterrupted water route from New Orleans to Quebec, separated by about 5 miles of land, not far from Fort St. Joseph. So that's one of the reasons there. And then that specific location, you know, why not closer to South Bend? And, well, there were shoals in the river there, so it might have been a place where people could have crossed easily. There is also proximity to a small stream that flows into the St. Joseph River. People probably weren't drinking their water right from the river. They're probably using that stream. So a number of different reasons. The site itself was not on a high bluff. It really wasn't in a defensible location, and the main function of the site was for commercial reasons. And so having ready access to the river where they could put goods into canoes and transport them easily was probably another factor in that sort of micro environment, that the micro topography of that location.
If my memory is correct, after many years and the fort wasn't used anymore, its location almost became unknown in later years.
Yeah, it was forgotten for a long time. So after it was abandoned, about 50 years later, the area was surveyed by the U.S. government. They were eager to survey the land so they could sell it. And surveyors walked very close to where the fort was. They made no record of it in 1827. The land was sold pretty quickly. The government was good at doing that. And settlers came in there in the 1830s and started plowing it. And as early as the 1830s and 40s, there were remnants of the fort that were turning up along the blade of the plow. And then local collectors were collecting at the site into the early 20th century. But over the course of the early 20th century, the river was dammed and the site became partly flooded and the area was used as a landfill. And so the exact location became forgotten. And it really wasn't until the 1990s when WMU was called in and using some leads from a local historian, Joseph Pizer, we were able to pinpoint the location, and then we were actually able to do excavations and actually recover physical remains of the fort. And we made the claim that Fort St. Joseph was indeed found.
As you mentioned, the present site of the fort is rather challenging from an excavation standpoint. What does that all involve?
Yeah, well, the river is still, the dam is still there. The river is still high. There's a flood pool behind the dam, and the site is seasonally inundated. So from probably fall into late spring, there's often standing water at the site. And we have a short window, usually in June, July, August, when we can get in. And even though the site is dry on the surface, the groundwater table is just centimeters of a foot or so beneath the surface of the ground surface. And so it necessitates us dewatering the site. Well, so we have these inch-and-a-half PVC pipes that go into the ground. And in essence, we just pump water out of the ground and lower the groundwater table to allow excavations to take place. And we've been doing that for almost 20 years now.
Is having the site underwater, does that help or hurt the preservation of the artifacts?
Well, the types of artifacts that often are poorly preserved in some Michigan sites that we have good preservation of at Fort St. Joseph is particularly animal remains, the bones from the meals that they were consuming. And these are remarkably well preserved. But still, items like leather or cloth and these sorts of things tend not to preserve even in this archaeological site. We have found some wood, some upright posts that are part of the buildings we've identified, and so that's exciting as well. So some wood and certainly bone is quite well preserved at the site, and that provides us with a lot more information about what they're eating and how they were building the houses.
What other kinds of things are you finding there?
Well, lots of everyday debris. So, you know, we mentioned that there was the military there, had a commercial function, and it also had a religious function. And so all of those activities are represented in, you know, religious medallions that were possibly inadvertently lost, or crosses, or these sorts of things. Objects associated with the fur trade, various goods that were probably intended to be traded to native peoples, like glass beads and other iron artifacts, like iron knives and axes and these sorts of things. The French maintained close relations with the native groups in the area. One of the things the native groups wanted was a blacksmith to repair their guns. We found evidence of where the blacksmith worked, so there are lots of gun parts on the site, various types of flintlock hardware, the mechanisms that held the flint and you know, fired the flint and sparked the flint and so on. All the mechanisms of these flintlock muskets have been found there, along with gun flints, some ceramics, glass, glass bottles, and again, tiny, tiny fragments for the most part, nails, architectural material, nails, hinges, and these sorts of things also, and other architectural debris like stones from fireplaces and so on. And so a range of artifacts, and then also evidence of the buildings themselves.
So this tells us not only about the Europeans who were there, but also the Native Americans.
Yeah, well, it's pretty good evidence that there were, in fact, some Native peoples living within the area that we're investigating now, although an 18th century map shows close to maybe 1,000 Natives living on the other side of the river. But for the most part, it's mostly evidence of Europeans. But it's interesting when you look at the artifacts. By, let's say, 1750, Native peoples had adopted lots of imported goods. And so the material assemblage looks similar, although there are still artifacts that are distinctive of both Native and European styles.
What does a more philosophical question, if you like, what does archaeology in this kind of context tell us what historical records cannot?
Yeah, well, what archaeology really gives us is very much the texture of daily life. So the records that we have were written by the priests. They're records of who was marrying who and who was being baptized. And the commandants also would have corresponded with people in Detroit or Mackinac, and they talk about their political ambitions or issues with Native peoples or these sort of larger policy issues, if you'd like. But what was really happening on the ground is not recorded in the documents, and this really emerges just from the archaeology. Again, something as mundane as what people were eating. So just as a quick example, people of French ancestry in France had been using domesticated animals for literally thousands of years. We would expect maybe that was what their diet would look like, beef, pork, chicken, lamb. Yet very few of those are represented in the animal bone assemblage. They're mostly eating deer, raccoon, beaver, turkey, swan, duck, goose, rabbit, these sorts of animals. So they're basically living sort of the way the natives were. They're hunting for their own subsistence and so on. And this is something that's somewhat, not completely unexpected, but it's not something that emerges from the documents. It's what the archaeology tells us.
And how did Western become involved in the excavation?
Well, just somewhat happenstance. I got a call in 1997, and the local people said, oh, help us find Fort St. Joseph. We said, yeah, we're happy to do it. We started rooting around in 1998, and we finally learned that, you know, people had been looking for the site for 100 years. They hadn't told us that. And sure enough, we got a little lucky. We dug a lot of shovel test pits in an area where other Michigan universities had also looked for the site, and we didn't find much. Some 18th century artifacts, but not evidence of the fort. And then a local collector showed up and showed us where he had been finding some artifacts, and sure enough, that was the location. We did further work there, And again, because it was so wet, it's an area that most archaeologists had avoided, forgetting that the river 250 years ago was about 12 feet lower. And so all the pieces kind of fell into place, and that's how it happened. We've been doing it ever since.
In addition to yourself and other faculty members, the excavation is mainly handled by grad students?
Yeah, we have graduate students involved and lots of undergrads as well. You know, we run the project as an archaeological field school, and so undergraduates and graduate students take the course for credit, and returning students like Liz, once they have some experience, they come back in either an internship or in a staff capacity, a paid capacity. And I mean, it's a project that involves a lot more than just digging also. Not that that's not an important part of what we do. But we do lab work, and there's various sets of analysis and a lot of publicity for the outreach that we do. And that's what certainly Liz is more involved with. But and we also train others. Besides university students, we also train members of the public. There are opportunities there that Liz is also involved with that as well. So,
and Liz Mantic, as mentioned, is in charge of that public outreach. Tell us a little bit about that aspect of the project.
Sure. So basically, one of my roles is to kind of engage the public in all different sorts of ways. So for example, during the summer months, we offer a lecture series at the Niles Public Library. So we bring in a guest lecturer, and each year for the field season, we have a theme. And this year it's focusing on waterways. So we're going to have a couple different lecturers come in and speak about their expertise and their knowledge on the riverways closely related to our project. So that is offered, like I said, just during the summer months. And then we offer summer camps as well for the public. So we do a middle school camp and we do a lifelong learners camp. And they can come in and they spend 3 hours in a classroom and they're learning a more extensive history of the fort. And then the coolest part is they actually get to come work with the students and staff of the project in the field every day too. So it's an exciting opportunity for them because they get to really see what we're doing as well. And that's a great opportunity for us to show them. And then our big cumulative event is our annual open house that we hold each year. So we're really looking forward to that this year.
You know, a lot of people's contact, if you want to call it that, with archaeology might be, you know, Indiana Jones, seeing a mummy in a museum or something like that. Do they find it? How do they react when they encounter the real thing?
I think they're pleasantly surprised by it. I think that they're able to see, what we're really doing and how Hollywood kind of, I don't want to say misconstrues it, but it's just the reality versus the expectation. And I hope that we don't disappoint. I don't think we do, but it's just exciting for them to come in and see live archaeology happening and for them to be able to feel like they're almost a part of the recreation of the history as well.
In a lot of scientific fields, you know, the public really is not involved in any way. Do you feel it's important to have that public connection with your work?
Absolutely. I think that it just shows them how things are created. And, we offer like site tours on Fridays we're going to be doing, so they can come and see and they get a feel for, you know, this is how we do it and why we do it. And here's, you know, how you can kind of be involved as well.
Okay. If someone comes to one of those site tours or to the open house, what are they going to see?
Well, they're going to see busy students hard at work. So they're going to see recreations of what life was like at the fort. They're going to see our different techniques and how we really just actually dig. And then, you know, we have at the open house, we have a series of like different events that they can go to. It's like a big reenactor history. So we have a bunch of reenactors that come in, and so they're able to kind of be able, they portray, you know, really what life was like. And so they can get a better feel for being almost in the moment, in the present with them.
And when is the open house this year?
The open house this year is the 7th and 8th of August. 6th and 7th
Saturday
of August.
Saturday and Sunday. Yep.
Yep.
And from what time?
10 to 4.
And lastly, before we wrap this up, is there anything either of you would like to add that we haven't touched on yet?
certainly want to invite the public to visit us during the open house. I think they often feed on the students' enthusiasm as well. Students get really charged up about being able to share what they've done for the previous 6 weeks and the knowledge that they have about archaeology and the local history and so on. And I think people really get charged up about that. It really demystifies the process as well. It shows how tedious it is and how exacting it is, and yet at the same time, we teach students from 10 years old up to 80 who involve themselves in the camp and so on, and they gain a new appreciation, I think, for what we do and how we do it.
I forgot to ask earlier, what happens to the artifacts once they're excavated?
Yeah, well, all the artifacts ultimately end up in a curation facility in Niles, right? And that's sort of the practice now with archaeologists is to keep materials locally, to keep them local. But in the process before that, they actually come to WMU. They're all cleaned and sorted and analyzed and so on, inventoried, and then they're returned. And so they become the basis for student theses and more intensive studies as well. One student now is actually looking at the metal gun parts from the site and looking to ascertain what countries they came from. Are they French? Are they English? What time periods and so on, and to help us better understand that aspect of the archaeology.
It's been ages since I've been to Niles, but didn't someone, maybe as a commercial venture, build what they called a recreation of the fort somewhere?
Not yet. That's been a dream of people in Niles, and whether or not it'll take a physical form of, it wouldn't be bricks and mortar. It would be like wood and clay, I guess. Whether it actually takes that physical form or it becomes something digital. I mean, we're constantly in the archaeology, we're reconstructing the past, but whether we're actually doing it on paper or digitally or physically is another matter. But I think that's something the public want because they can more readily conjure up what this actually looked like. The question that you asked earlier, what did this place look like? People want a sense of that and sort of moving through that space and so on.